WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Today, for Reading and Writing and Radio, I'm a roving reporter, interviewing people on the street, on a topic dear to all of us, making money. Here's a likely candidate coming along. Sir, would you answer a few questions?
Sure.
I'd like to talk to you about making money. All of us, when we were kids and even older, have come up with schemes to make money. And some of these have been pretty inventive. Sometimes an idea worked and we did make some money. More often, they bombed. Sometimes they never got past the idea stage or were nipped in the bud by our parents or some other adult. So would you first of all tell us your name and your age and then your scheme for making money?
Well, my name is Jeremy Schmidt. I'm 30 now, but when I had this scheme I was about 7, I think it was. Based on Kool-Aid stands at the local golf course. I went up one day and found that if we sat at the back of hole number 5, we could sell more Kool-Aid than we could possibly produce, at least more than we could haul in our little wagon up to the green. And so I decided maybe the thing to do was to expand and get my friends in on it, start a franchise, sort of like a Kool-Aid chain going from one hole to another. And we almost got it set. We actually built a booth and was going to get another couple of kids in the neighborhood together so that they would run that other booth. And it was about that time that the person selling Coke up at the clubhouse found all about that, and they kicked us off the golf course. That was the end of the franchise.
Was your stand on wheels so that you could move it from hole to hole, the ones that you built?
Yes, we'd haul it on a wagon, actually, partly so that we could move it along. It was about a mile to the golf course, and we'd just haul it on that, filled with the Kool-Aid and lemonade. Lemonade, I remember, was a bigger cup. It was a nickel, but we only had one cup. It was a paper cup, and we'd wash it, and some people didn't like that. I'd tell this person I was doing it with to go back and wash the paper cup, and at that point, people would decide they didn't want any. We decided we had to get some new cups at one point.
Well, then you did have low overhead in that you weren't buying a whole lot of paper cups and napkins and things. Where did you get your supplies? Who paid for the Kool-Aid and the sugar?
Mother's cupboard.
Did Mother notice that it was gone?
I'm not sure. Sugar was pretty cheap then, but we did get it on the sly. That's why we only had one cup, of course, because we could only find one Kool-Aid or one large lemonade cup that day.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schmidt, for telling us your scheme for making money. Here comes another passerby. It happens to be my father. Sir, would you tell me if you ever had any scheme when you were little about making money? Tell us your name first and an approximate age.
Oh, this is Ron Dogan, and I'm somewhere between 70 and 100. But this is when I was a little boy that it occurred to me that there would be a big market for frogs' legs in Chicago. And I was just the man, the individual to supply frog legs on contract to some of the Chicago hotels. Never having been in Chicago, but I was sure that they could use frog legs and would like a good source of frogs. Well, there happened to be a little depression in the pasture that was about as big as a small living room. It's a little water in the bottom and four or five reeds sticking up and a couple of cattails. And a couple of good-sized frogs, not the kind of frogs that you eat, that you see at restaurants nowadays and so forth. I mean, with drumsticks like a leghorn hen. But to my eyes, they're pretty good frogs, and I thought there was my start. But I had to confine the frogs, and they'd have to reproduce for me in this swampy little spot. And I didn't have any money for equipment. first thing I had to do was to surround the farm with a frog-tight fence. So I took the idea to my father and explained what I had in mind and how this little piece of marsh could be turned into a very productive proposition. And all I wanted from him was to get some woven wire fence that the frog wouldn't crawl through or jump over. And then we would just watch our profits roll in. Of course, I had to analyze how I would go about getting the quantity of frogs that I would need. I thought they would just multiply like rabbits. I had some experience with rabbits. But my father looked on the whole idea with a very sour eye. In the first place, inasmuch as my allowance is only 15 or 20 cents a week, I expect, the idea of buying fencing to enclose a pond or a marsh area to raise frogs didn't seem to him at all practical. And I argued with him to great length. And he tried to persuade me that we didn't know very much about frog culture and that he wasn't prepared to get into an adventure that was seemed so shaky. And he turned me down. And I remember I thought he was the most short-sighted man that there ever was. So that was a frog farm. It never developed. And I don't think there was a real population of frogs in that area anyway. Just a couple hopping through that I happened to see.
And then, of course, you hadn't thought ahead to, once you had your frogs, how you would market them to the Chicago market.
I hadn't thought of slaughtering them or icing them, or I hadn't thought of the butchering and getting the legs prepared and delivered to the hotels. I was going to have a half a dozen of the major Chicago hotels looking to me for their supply of frogs.
Well, that's a good story. You're telling me that reminds me of my scheme when I was little for making money. I don't know if you ever knew about it, but every so often us kids would go and get a big milk crate out of the storeroom and drag it out to the road and go down into the root cellar under the big house there at Graham and Grandpa's house and carry out a few tired-looking carrots and five or six potatoes and a few other things out of the root cellar and arrange them on top of this crate and put up a sign saying for sale, and we would have a vegetable stand. But you and I know what the radio listeners don't know is that Collie Road that we lived on didn't have any population driving along it other than the people that lived right there on the road, and all those people had their own carrots and tomatoes and potatoes and so forth too. So nobody ever, ever stopped at our vegetable stands. And we would sit there for hours and finally give up and go do something else. So there was another scheme for making money that never came to anything. Here comes a likely candidate. It's Chad Walsh, my first writing teacher when I was in college. Chad, did you have any schemes when you were a kid for making money?
Now, Jackie, I had them all the time, but usually I didn't make any money.
Could you tell us some of them?
Well, I was going to set up a small candy factory in our kitchen, but it was in the Depression. We never had enough capital to get the equipment we needed. One thing I did make money in the farm, that was delivering handbills.
What's a handbill?
Handbill, an advertisement, a little sheet of paper advertising whatever the store wants to advertise. And they were printed at the local print shop, and the print shop would arrange to have them distributed. And I got a penny a piece going from house to house with them and really felt that I was making pretty good money.
About how old were you at this time?
It's hard for me to say. I imagine about 15, 16.
Mm-hmm. You weren't a little boy then?
No, as a little boy, I can't recall ever earning any money.
Well, when did you first start to have schemes that really did earn money?
I suppose I was in high school. There was a local justice of the peace, and I used to type legal forms for him with a lot of carbon copies. He said that as long as I could sell them as cheaply as a print shop would, he'd buy from me.
Now, you mentioned to me that you learned to type at quite an early age.
About the age of 10, yes. My brother had a typewriter and instruction book for the touch system, and I guess I was just getting interested in trying to write at that time, and learning to use a typewriter seemed a good idea. So I taught myself with a book.
So later on, then, you turned it to good use to make some money.
Thank heavens I did learn touch typing. I don't think I'd be a writer if I hadn't.
Have you any other schemes that materialized or did not?
Well, when I was in high school age, there was a chance for me to be a part-time linotype operator working for Sherwood Anderson's two country newspapers. So again, I got an instruction book and learned the very different keyboard arrangement of a linotype.
And let's see, a linotype is the machine that sets the type for...
Yeah, they're almost obsolete now. Photographic processes have taken the place of a linotype, but it was like a big typewriter, kind of mechanical typesetter.
Would you have any advice for youngsters today who are wanting to make money?
Well, I don't feel that I'm a very good one to give advice because I wasn't remarkably successful.
So far, I don't think we've talked to anybody that was.
I think the obvious advice to look around and to see if there's some kind of lack. For instance, in your community, is there something that a lot of people want to have done, but there seems to be no one doing it, like taking care of lawns, splitting wood, and so on? You may step into a vacuum.
I keep suggesting things that I would like to pay money for, but my kids never seem to want to do those jobs. They have other ideas.
Yeah, it depends on whether you're looking for something glamorous or whether you're just looking for some money, I think. And I'm thinking about the person who will do about anything as long as he can get paid for it.
We used to have to put cuffs on the milk bottles in the dairy when they would come around from having been filled. We would drop an advertising cuff that would be sort of like the handbill because it would go right to the house. And after a whole morning of putting cuffs on those milk bottles, why, Grandpa would give us a dime. We figured that was a little bit tight. I think you did a little better by getting a penny for every handbill you delivered. We would have made several dollars, I'm sure.
I know when I was doing this work as a linotype operator, I started at 25 cents an hour and did all right, I guess. I was promoted to 35, and there I remained stuck.
And was that good pay for that time?
It wasn't bad for the Depression period.
Well, thank you, Chad Walsh.
Nice to see you again, Jackie.
Well, well, here comes a woman of great experience. It happens to be my mother, Vera Dogan, who is also somewhere between 70 and 100. Mother, will you speak to us on this subject? Did you make money when you were little?
Yes, I made money when I was little. Where I lived in Chicago, we had a very unique neighborhood because it was all centered around Congress Park and all the families had children. We were all close. We had a club. We had a club. Every night we used to go out after supper and play ring games. And I don't think they do that anymore. And I think it's a shame because it kept alive all of our folklore. But that was part of it. And we would learn all the things that everybody else learned in that group. It was a unique group. If one had a new dancing step, we'd all follow and learn it, and new songs we'd learn, and so forth. Then what to do with all this wonderful talent, you see? So what we would do would be to put on a show. And the wonderful part of it was that the Episcopal Church always let us use their parish hall for nothing.
You mean you would put on these shows right in a regular parish hall and do singing and dancing and things like that? How old were you?
Yes, about 10.
And your friends were 10 around, too?
They were all around from 8 to 12, I presume. We were all youngsters because our families all stood back of us and the church especially was very pleased that we wanted to use their hall, and they didn't make us pay anything for it.
Well, how much did you charge your audience?
But we charged our audience about 5 cents or maybe 10 cents.
And would you get very many in your audience?
Oh, we always had it full. And then the money that we'd make for the Fresh Air Fund. At that time, there was a Fresh Air Sanitarium in Lincoln Park on the lake. And the little babies that were in need of fresh air and competent care were taken out to this place in Lincoln Park. And so whenever we gave shows, it was just decided that the money would go to the Fresh Air Fund. And the shows that we gave were showing off what we could do.
Well, tell me what...
Showing our parents and our friends what things we could do and how well we could do them.
Well, tell me what you did.
Well, one of the things that I did, one of the programs that we gave was saluting all the different countries. And we got costumes and made them so that we all took turns saluting the different nations.
Well, how did you salute a nation? You, Vera, little Vera.
Well, how I saluted the nation was that I did a little French dance, and I also did a song, a French song. I don't know.
Can you sing us the French song that you sang? Do you remember it?
I'd rather not try to... trying to do it with this voice, which is I have a bad cold at the moment. But I sang a little French song all the way through, and then I did a little French dance. And my chum Hilda Duck would sing "Rule of Britannia." The ducks had come from England, and so she always gave the song "Rule Britannia rules the waves. Britons never will be slaves." And I found it very hard to accompany that song because of that special
That Hilda sang it that way.
Yes, I had to accompany Hilda. Well, Hilda. That's the way it's written, but it would be hard for a little girl of 10 to play it right. But I'd learn it, and then Hinda would come out with a British flag, and many of them were costumed exactly as they should be in the Norwegian dress. And all kinds of things were pulled out of the attics, and when we would get a show ready, and it would have to be about an hour and a half anyway.
Sounds like a tremendous production. Would it take you all summer, or would you whip these up rather rapidly?
We'd whip them up. We'd do maybe two a summer. And the people knew they were going to be good, too, so they all came. And I know now that they must have had some awfully funny times behind their hands and giggling at us, but they took it seriously enough to make us feel that they were having a wonderful time and that this was a very excellent production.
Well, it sounds a great way of making money to me, Mother, and I wish I could have seen one of those productions, but of course I wasn't around at the time. You played the piano for all the singers and dancers on these shows, Mother?
Yes, I accompanied all of the various acts that we had. We had different themes each time we gave one, but it was much easier to have a special pianist ready to take over, and that was one thing that I did. There was one more thing that made money at those shows, and that is that a beautiful doll had been selected and was in waiting.
You mean had been bought? You kids bought a doll?
A beautiful doll, yes. We bought a beautiful doll and it was in waiting. And we allowed the people that came to the show and the people that were in the show, we allowed them each to guess what the name of the doll was. none of us knew what it was, and we all evening long kept getting $5, 5 cents and 10 cents chance on this doll. And nobody knew what the name was except one of the mothers, who wouldn't give out at all what it was, and there was no hanky-panky about it. We just made money all evening long on the doll.
What if nobody guessed the doll's name?
Well, it came pretty close to it. One night we had gotten practically all through, and I was trying so hard to think of some unusual name because I wanted the doll, and different ones did. But finally somebody guessed the name, and her name was Roxanna, which you can see is an unusual name for a doll.
And the prize was to receive the doll if you got the name.
That's right.
And the money from the doll then went to the Fresh Air Fund,
went,
too.
Went into that. The money from the doll went right into that money for the Fresh Air Fund.
Well, thank you, Mother, for telling us your unusual ways of making money. We'll have one final interview. I'm here at Roxy Alexander's, not Roxanna, and Roxy is of my generation, meaning a bit over 50. Roxy, did you have any money? Did you make any money when you were a kid?
Yes, I did. I lived in a house with three bachelor uncles and my grandparents. My uncles were always dating, and often there was a great crisis as they got ready to go out on a date, and I would be allowed to shine their shoes, 10 cents a shoe, a quarter for the pair if I did an extra good job and made them very shiny. Other days, I would be told I could go clean out the car. I liked to do this because I often found Wild West books in the car that they had been reading. It was during the Depression. There weren't any jobs. They sat on the front porch and read Wild West magazines. I read them, too, because I'd find them in the car when I was cleaning it out. I look back and think now that I had more spending money than most of the kids I went to school with, although we had no more money in our house. But my uncles always made sure I had a quarter in my jeans, as they said. One uncle was a soda jerk at the local drugstore. He made $15 a week. We called him the cash customer. We ate what he liked to eat in the house. At this drugstore, they had a raffle. You'd go in and punch a little key, and if you got the magic number, you'd get two candy bars instead of one. And one time, I got five. That was the biggest. And he said I couldn't have all five candy bars at once. I'd become ill. So I would go in every 3 days and say, well, remember, I've got that extra candy bar coming, until I'd eaten about 10. And finally, he said, the deal is off. I'd had more than I...
You'd collected on your raffle right. Ticket much more than that. Well, that sounds...
Babysitters were a very new thing in Osage County in the 30s in Kansas. My mother had the first babysitter in town and was criticized very much. Other people left children with aunts or uncles or parents. Mother hired the girl next door. That was not done before. When I grew up, I was babysitting, very special thing because it was the high school band director, and he was very popular.
How old were you when you first...
I was a freshman in high school.
All right.
I got 10 cents an hour. I would appear at a quarter of 11, and he would and his wife would go to church, and I would sit with a baby till church was over, and I got 10 cents. But the honor, because he was so popular, was greater than the amount of money. I was envied for that job.
Well, now, of course, babysitting is the way that lots of people
right.
make their money. So kids, there was the first babysitting and only 10 cents an hour. Thank you, Roxy Alexander.
All right, you listeners of Reading and Writing and Radio, you've heard some stories from us of the older generations. Now it's your turn. What schemes have you had for making money?
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.